continuing orientation on natural gas, overview of natural gas from the Office of the Public Advocate, Mr. Schneider.
Good morning.
You.
Members of the committee.
Illinois as well, for that matter. Thanks for coming.
No problem. The road's got a little hairy as I drove north. In my previous comments, I like to anchor things in the bill, so we're going to talk a little bit about the customer experience of the gas bill and how it looks different between gas utilities, and I think we use that to talk a little bit about the larger question of the gas policy for the state of Maine and how the commission sets it. So as Chairman Vannoy mentioned, the gas bill is broken up into two parts, delivery and supply. So delivery is the cost of constructing, operating, and maintaining that local gas distribution infrastructure. So typically, you have a fixed upfront charge and a usage-based charge. That'll be familiar to most of you from the electricity context. Sometimes there'll be specific surcharges like an EMT surcharge or an environmental surcharge to cover one-off expenses, but generally that in Maine at least, it's that structure. It's fixed charge, usage charge. That's all set at the PUC, and it varies widely from company to company across the state. If you look on page 2, we put together a chart that shows what just the delivery charge. This, to be clear, this is not the full portion of your bill, but for a residential customer who's a heating customer, what your delivery charge might look like depending on where you live and where you take service. This chart has gotten a lot more complicated since the last time we put it together 2 years ago. But there's four main gas utilities: Bangor Gas, Maine Natural Gas, Summit Natural Gas, and Unitil. As you'll see, that fixed customer charge varies pretty widely depending on who you are and where you are. So Bangor Gas has the lowest, around $14. And new Augusta residential customers have the highest in the state at $35. Those differences in rates reflect the different circumstances and the different approaches that the commission has used in setting rates for those different utilities. The Maine gas statute was adopted at a time when we were seeing some of those first pipelines come through the state, and we wanted to give the commission the utmost flexibility to set rates. How you set rates for a new gas company looks really different than you might do it for a more established company, and the commission's early decisions around pricing reflect that. The basic idea being, if you have a cost of service-based approach and you have one customer, that customer would have to bear all the costs. And that's not good if you're trying to attract customers, but you want to provide a little more flexibility so they can get to scale. You might entertain some alternative mechanisms. And the Maine gas statute gives the commission a lot of flexibility to do that. I've reproduced the statute here just so if you want to read through it and see. It's really remarkable. Having litigated this statute, the commission can do almost anything it would like to do under this. But as a result, the approach that we use for setting gas rates, or the commission uses for setting gas rates, varies widely across gas utilities and even within different gas utilities. So, for example, Bangor Gas's rates are set based on the commission and Bangor Gas estimates of what oil prices would be in the late 90s and sort of subject to an annual escalator moving forward. And the commission, in their most recent rate case, decided to continue that, notwithstanding, obviously, those prices have changed a lot in that time. And a change in ownership in the intervening time that sold the company for almost nothing. Summit Natural Gas, by comparison, their prices were set based on, they came into the state, said, these are the rates we need to build a gas utility here. And so they got a 10-year plan. Bangor Gas is, I think, on a 7-year plan. Summit got a 10-year plan. Those rates are their rates for 10 years, and you bear the risk of whether or not those rates are enough to cover your costs based on what your future projections of customer count would be. Unitil is probably closest to a traditional cost of service. They're under an alternative rate plan, but it's based in cost of service. But even there, you have a little bit different depending on where you live. They've recently pursued an expansion in the Saco area, and they came to the commission and said, we want to start with our sort of traditional rates, but we want to have an adder that allocates the cost of that expansion just to the people who live there, not to customers in, say, Portland or Lewiston who are far from there. They keep their rates the same, and that surcharge will cover the cost of that expansion. So that's the reason you see different rates between SACO and Unitil. Unitil's on a 3-year plan. It's up for, I think it expires this year. Probably the most complex of these three is Maine Natural Gas. So here you have basically three classes of customers, and this is the result of a stipulation approved last year by the commission? It was last year. The years all been together, blend together. I think it was last year. So, and so there you have rates. You have sort of three different sets of rates. You have the rates for customers who don't live in the Augusta area. You have rates for customers who lived in the Augusta area but took service before the rate case happened. And you have rates for future Augusta customers going forward. And they're all set in different ways. So the non-Augusta rates are pretty close to a cost of service rate. The Augusta ones cover some of the incremental cost of the expansion to the Augusta area. The commission's conclusion was that it wasn't appropriate to charge people in other parts for the cost of the expansion into Augusta. And then there's rates going forward for new Augusta customers, which are based off of the prices of competitive fuels. This is something we generally don't support because we think that once someone takes service from a gas utility, they're a captive customer, and so the price of competitive fuels isn't super relevant for that customer once they're there. We're more comfortable, frankly, with a cost of service approach or something rooted in that. But the commission staff in particular was adamant about moving in that direction. So as you can see, it's tough to say that we have one way we do gas. We actually have at least 4 and maybe 7 different approaches to setting gas rates that the commission has adopted, reflecting that flexibility that the statute gives them, and the different kind of vintage. So Bangor Gas has been in operation for quite a long time now, for 15 years, but they have rates that are still based on this alternative mechanism. Maine Natural Gas has 3 different kind of approaches depending on who you are and when you took service. It's kind of all over the map. But that those different structures reflect different rates. So you can see the delivery charge for each of those customers looks very different depending on where you live. So Summit has the highest, and Augusta new customers have, you know, almost $30 more a month they're paying than a similarly situated Maine Natural Gas customer who doesn't live in Augusta, which is pretty uncommon in the utility space. Usually we see relatively equal rates regardless of where you live within a utility service territory. So that's the delivery charge. I'm going to switch gears to supply charges, but I wanted to kind of tell that story. On the supply side, I want to be clear that we're just talking about the delivery charge there. There's a whole other portion of the bill, and particularly during the winter months when you're doing a lot of usage, that supply portion can be quite high. So the supply charge is the cost of the gas that is the commodity that gets delivered. So if we're paying through the delivery charge, the cost of getting it to you, we got to get something to you, and we pay separately for that supply portion of the bill. And while it's true and sort of in general terms that the companies go out and buy it and then the commission reviews that, it's a pass-through of cost. The approach, again, varies depending on which utility you are. Some utilities do it annually. Some utilities do it monthly. Again, Maine Natural Gas has 2 options, a fixed price and a variable option. Unitil has an on-peak, off-peak. So, there's not one singular approach here. And that seems to reflect less the sort of circumstances of the utility and just what the company came in and said they wanted to do, and the commission's like, you can do that. I think one distinction I wanted to flag here between the approach in the electricity context and in the gas context is in the electricity context, we allow all customers to take supply from a competitive supplier. But in the gas context, we only really allow larger commercial industrial customers to do it. Those folks can go out and procure supply separately from a supplier like Sprague or I'm going to blank on my other – but there are large suppliers who come into the market and offer supply. But residential customers and small business customers, they take what the company gets for them. Sort of the equivalent of the standard offer, but for gas supply. Again, these are pass-throughs. Company goes out and gets it. subject to some review by the commission to make sure that, you know, it costs what you said it costs, or if it costs more, we'll make sure that you get, you're made whole for that. These are just a pass-through of costs. So then on the bottom of page 3, we've put together what the actual bill looks like in February for each of those different subsets of each of those different companies once you add in the supply portion of the bill. And you'll see we've added additional complexity here just because everyone needs to get comfortable with complexity in this committee. MNG has a fixed price option and an index price option, so that's that variable and that fixed or fixed and variable option. So within MNG, even within those three different classes of customers, your prices might look different depending on whether you accept a fixed or an index priced option. And again, I mostly just want to flag that what you pay for gas and how you pay for it will vary depending on where you take service and what pricing options you choose. And you can see they're sort of in the ballpark, but there can be significant difference in those winter months depending on who you take service from.
Representative Gregerson. Sorry. I saw the hand, and I knew roughly where the hand was coming from. I was just slightly off. Senator Cushing, being new. Did you get a chance to introduce yourself earlier?
I did.
Earlier?
Okay, just wanted to start and then had to step up.
Excellent. Proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Schneider, for being here and as a new apostle to this committee. Please bear with me if these questions are a little out of or redundant. It appears as I look at this that the delivery charge remains relatively constant based upon the volume that goes to the customer. So the delivery charge has some variation, but it has a basis different than the supply of the actual gas.
The variation between utilities, you're saying?
Well, does the charge, is there a flat base charge and then based on the volume that you, as with the water, you have in some cases a base charge that a water utility will charge to provide service to a home, and then the volume of water may have some impact on the delivery cost.
Right.
Is that similar in the gas situation?
Yes. I think it's for the supply portion of your bill. Remember those two portions of your bill, there's the delivery charge and there's the supply portion. The supply portion is all variable. There's no fixed charge. You just pay on a per unit. However much gas you use, you pay that per unit price for that gas. For the delivery portion of your bill, that is like you described. You have a fixed upfront charge and then a variable charge. Yes.
Okay. It appears to me, as a novice, that, and I recognize there are substantial mobilization costs to put this in, but we're seeing one area of the state that has two suppliers that has predominantly the higher rates compared to other areas of the state that are being provided. Granted, those have suppliers who may have been in place longer, but do we see a point where those delivery charges may settle down or even potentially be lowered, or is that not something that historically has happened in the development of new service to communities?
It depends on how you set rates. So if you set rates based on the price of competitive fuels, as the commission has experimented with in the case of Bangor Gas or in the case of Maine Natural Gas new Augusta customers, then no. Those prices will be, you know, the company has some opportunity to vary price depending on competition, but there's no reason that those prices would decline because it's not tied to the cost of providing service. If you set prices based on the cost of service, if you increase the number of customers or you depreciate some of that investment over time, then yes, you would expect those prices to fall in the future in a way that would lower costs for the customers, yes.
Please.
Is there a model from the public advocate's position that you or colleagues in other states have found to be more successful on behalf of the public?
The Maine's approach to allow gas competition, like pipes side by side in the ground, is nationally unique. No one else does that. And I'm not even sure Maine, when it initiated that policy, thought that that would happen. I think the commission made a decision at the time of that initial expansion to not choose winners and losers, to say anyone who wants to come in, they can figure out to provide service, go for it. And we're not going to you know, say, you're the best gas company to provide service here. What that has meant is what they said at the time was like, well, we think the market will make rational decisions. People won't put pipes side by side in the street. And in fact, when Summit and Maine Natural Gas were competing in the Augusta area, that actually happened, right? We saw that happen. That is not necessarily bad for customers. I think there is some evidence to suggest you might have seen more expansion than you otherwise would have because of that competition, though unclear. I mean, there's no how do you test that, right? The kicker for us is when you set that policy in place, the risk of those uneconomic decisions needs to fall to shareholders, not customers. So if we're going to be in a competitive paradigm here, we need to make sure that if a company makes uneconomic investments, in which it appears that Maine Natural Gas did in the Augusta area, they built out mains to customers who didn't ultimately take service to them. Customers, the bulk of customers, shouldn't bear that risk. They shouldn't bear those incremental costs. And I think the commission's precedent, when we litigated the Bangor Gas case all the way to the law court and were unsuccessful there, the original owner wrote down the value of those assets to zero and sold them for about $500,000, practically less than zero when you account for the tax losses. And those rates didn't change for those customers. So who actually bore the risk of that uneconomic growth, right? And similarly, in Maine Natural Gas, we've shifted some of the costs going forward to the customers in the Augusta area, but it's sort of in a black box stipulation, so you can't say who paid what. We found something we got comfortable with given the litigation risk, but it's not altogether clear who bore the risk of that expansion now that it's all said and done. And I think that's our big concern with policies that don't set rates based on cost, or don't anchor them in cost at least, or things that when we do gas competition, we have competition side by side. We want to make sure that the risk of bad investments doesn't come back to ratepayers. And I don't think that's been the case in Maine.
Representative Sandborn?
I have a vague recollection from when I first bought a house that Northern Utilities was one of the worst customer service providers, rivaling Time Warner Cable maybe in its notoriousness for not being helpful. And I don't remember the specifics of that. And obviously that company doesn't exist in the same form anymore. But I just had a run-in with Unitil on Monday where I asked them if they could consolidate at least the due dates of my four gas meters to be at the same time of the month, and they said, nope. But you can put them all in one check. I said, sure, great, except for they're due at four different times during the month, every single month. So I'm curious what you're hearing in terms of complaints, both from consumers or small business customers with regard to natural gas providers.
To be honest, we get very few natural gas calls. The two classes of calls we tend to get the first is, I would like natural gas to come down my street. Less frequent now, given the trend in oil and natural gas prices, but they won't come, or we don't, you know, it's too expensive. And we sometimes get calls from small business customers who are like, I'm not using gas, but I'm still paying a substantial bill. Like, well, that's a rate design question. We've decided to put much of that cost on a fixed charge, and there's a rate case, which happened 3 years ago. You know, it's sort of confusing to explain to people, but those are the two classes of calls that we get when we get gas calls, but they're relatively infrequent. That said, our office is always available, as is the Consumer Assistance Division at the PUC, to help deal with issues. So feel free to reach out.
Representative Hanley.
Yes, I just on these fixed transmission costs, I'm going to pick on one company and just help me with it. The new Augusta customers is $35. So if they double the amount of customers, will that automatically drop that rate if they increase their customer base?
It won't change that rate until they do their next rate case.
Is that automatic, or does that have to go before the PUC? Does someone have to litigate that on behalf of the customers?
They will come in and say, here's what we'd like our rates to be. We need to change our rates, but if they don't come in, it would have to be litigated. Yeah.
All right, so who does that? Who would initiate that? And how would a customer know that, well, it's time for a change?
when a company files for a change in rates, they are required to notify all their customers that they are having a rate proceeding and what that rate change would be. So that's sort of the first notice. Yeah. Typically, there's also newspaper articles and stuff like that.
But is that part of your job as the advocate?
To notify customers?
No, I mean to keep an eye on these things.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And so we hired expert witnesses. We extensively litigated that case and all these gas cases.
So you're watching customer growth. You get all those numbers.
And so the way Commissioner Vannoy or Chairman Vannoy mentioned this yesterday, but you know, the basic principle when you're at least doing cost-based rates, which not all of these are, but you would say, here's how much it costs to deliver service to these customers, to run our system, to deliver a service, and we need to recover all that money somehow. So then first you divide it up into different classes of customers. We're going to get this much from our commercial industrial, this much from our residential, and then based on usage, we're going to figure out how we collect that money from customers. And so to do that calculation, you're absolutely right. There's some estimate of what the number of customers would be, and it might grow over time. And that's going to be how you break up that number. And so if you double the customers and you had, then you presumably have to recover half of those costs from each customer, right? That's right, but those estimates go into that rate case. That's one of the things we look at. Are your estimates of usage, in case of usage, and are your estimates of the number of customers realistic? One of the things we note is there's a tendency for a utility to say, when it's time to build infrastructure, to say, we have a lot of demand, we need to build customers. And then when it comes time to do a rate case, they're like, we don't have as many customers, we're not that much usage, because then rates need to be higher.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on that.
Please.
So to follow up on Representative Hanley's question, yesterday in that, in order to review our rates, it's basically the utility that's going to ask for the increase. All right? So if they're going along and the gas prices is going down, but they're keeping their rates the same, they probably are not going to come in for a rate change. And if there was growth, which he was asking, how does the customer intervene there?
Well, I want to make a distinction. So when the commodity price is going down, that's just a pass-through. No one's making any more money, more or less money on that. The gas company's going out and buying gas for customers. So if natural gas prices drop by a dollar a dekatherm, then that just gets passed through, and that happens automatically for each of these utilities. I think the point that Representative Hanley made was, what if the number of customers increases? You're collecting the same amount. We made out of a counter for that customer growth when we did the rate case. So some of that is baked into how... These are alternative rate plans, right, for example. So Summit came in and said, we want this rate plan to be in effect for 10 years. And so they showed, here what our customer projections are going to be. If this has not been the case, but if they had, they blew away their customer estimates. They had a lot more customers than they had projected. They'll make a lot more money. And that's a deliberate feature of that plan, is we want to provide them some incentive to get more customers. But for 10 years... we've agreed under the alternative rate plan mechanism, we're not touching that. In fact, there's a provision in statute, which I omitted here, which basically says if you sign on to an alternative rate plan, you can't blow that up in the middle. So for some of these defined terms of a rate plan, Bangor Gas has a 7-year plan. We've made some estimates about what the future looks like, and we're not touching that until then. And that's to provide regulatory certainty for those companies, to give them an incentive to get more customers. That might be a thing you want to do. We might also, rate cases are expensive, and those costs, like all utility costs, are borne by ratepayers eventually. We might want to not do those all the time because they're burdensome and expensive. So there is some value in saying, don't come back for 3 years. We don't want to do that. We'll let you run, and we'll come back in 3 years. For most of these, one of the other benefits of this is that that defined terms means that at the end of 3 years, at the end of 7 years, or at the end of 10 years in the case of Summit, we're coming back and we're looking at this all again. Under a traditional cost of service, you could just ride that out and there would be no, unless you needed more money, either the utility needed more money, or unless someone initiated an investigation, which you can do under Maine law. Otherwise, those rates would just stay in place. So there are some trade-offs with these different approaches.
Senator Cushing.
Yes, I opened the ball here. as I understand this, and correct me if I'm wrong, the providers of the gas acquire the gas. They're not carrying other companies' gas through their transmission lines to customers.
Let's talk about local distribution. Okay. So make a distinction between okay. – I'm not going to talk about interstate pipelines.
If that's too deep, that's fine. But terms of the players that we're talking about here, are they generally acquiring the gas and then reselling it, or are they transmitting other parties' product in intrastate to
– Both.
Okay.
So let's take Unitil as an example. If you're a residential customer in Unitil's service territory, Unitil goes out and they do this. They have a peak and an on-peak, so they do it in the.
Have you already covered this? Because if so, I'll ask somebody off.
No, I can. It's. Okay. I think it's okay. Worth. I think usually there's never just one around a UT. There's always one more than
okay.
one more person who asks that same okay. question. So, Unitil goes off and they say, okay, we got to make sure we have gas for that coldest day in winter. So we're going to buy pipeline capacity, we're going to buy peaking capacity, we're going to buy commodity, and we're going to transport it. And in actually Unitil's case, they have storage facilities all the way out in the Midwest, and then they have to buy pipeline capacity to transport that gas all the way back. And it comes to the city gate outside of Portland, it's in Westbrook, and it gets delivered into the Unitil system in the Portland area, right? So in that case, if you're that residential customer, it flows through Unitil's system, through their distribution network, and it's delivered at your house. That gas was bought by Unitil for you, and they've carried it all the way. They carried it from the city gate to you, and they contracted to get it through the system to you. So in that case, they own it. They hold title to it. It's their gas. If you are a large commercial industrial customer in that same system, you have the option to say, thanks, Unitil. See that you'd be willing to buy that for me, but I'm actually going to go contract with, say, Sprague, and they're going to get gas on my behalf. So you negotiate separately with Sprague. It shows up on you get a bill from Sprague, and Sprague has the responsibility of all that stuff that I just described that Unitil did. They do that for their customers, and they are required to deliver that gas to Unitil Citygate. Here's the gas for our customers. If they deliver a little less, there's a whole process for working that out, or a little more. But someone in that case, someone else has procured the gas for you and delivered it to the gas distribution system, and then Unitil is responsible for delivering it there. Does that make sense?
It does. Excellent question. Thank you. Representative Riley.
Following up on that, would a large industrial customer be apt to stick with one supplier then, or will they contract variously with different suppliers, chasing prices?
If you're a really large industrial customer, you might take service directly off an interstate pipeline, so you might not deal with these local distribution companies at all. I don't know about whether they move between suppliers or not. I assume that market is competitive, but we don't see a lot because those people handle their own business. Last page. We are sometimes curious what Maine's natural gas policy is. We're kind of agnostic on this, but the public advocate is not clear on what our gas policy is, and that's what I meant. So I've quoted a couple different places where you kind of see the hints of what the state's gas policy might be, but it shows up in places, right? So. There's this quote from this commission order. This is in the Bangor Gas case where we were fighting over what rates should be in effect. And the commission says, the current state energy policy strongly supports expansion of natural gas service in Maine. So we're like, normally when someone says there's a state energy policy, we go to statute. Where's? And there was no cite to statute. But this is an argument that that Bangor Gas had made, and they referenced some language in the annual report from the commission, which I was unable to find for this presentation. but it's... who sets that policy? My assumption is it's the legislature, but there really isn't good guidance in statute about what the gas policy of the state is. Are we promoting expansion? Are we promoting expansion of distribution networks? Are we promoting expansion of interstate pipelines? Do we want people to switch to gas or not? I mean, this is we are agnostic on that question. Like, we don't, just give us, like, tell us the customers we're responsible for, and then we'll, like, try and represent their interests. But it's really a policy decision for the legislature and for not us. So I've quoted the language from Section 2104 here, which suggests that we want to promote gas expansion, right? It says we are actually not in the business of deciding who comes in. If you want to come in and provide gas service, go ahead. You don't have to ask us. You don't ask us for approval if there's no other gas utility serving there. That's remarkably permissive as state laws go, because normally they lock that down, right? The commission's like, you do not provide gas service anywhere without asking us first, even if it's in a place where... So that suggests something, kind of a permissive approach that would suggest we are in favor of gas distribution expansion. I've quoted some language from the Maine Energy Cost Reduction Act, which I thought would be stronger, actually, when I went back to look at it, but it's pretty tame. It's like, expansion of gas transmission capacity could result in lower natural gas prices and lower electricity prices. And there's the addendum from last session around gas storage that under certain circumstances, gas storage may have the potential to decrease, and it's like pretty tepid as that kind of language goes for like a policy statement. You know, you're making a legislative finding. It's like, this thing might happen. And it shows up, like, it shows up in commission proceedings. How we allocate costs between existing and customers and expansion. So I give the example of Unitil, right? They're expanding into Saco. So if you wanted to promote expansion into Saco, you might say, we're okay with existing customers bearing some of that cost to make it more affordable to do that expansion. Or there's a bunch of sort of regulatory steps you might take if it were an explicit policy to expand gas distribution infrastructure. Similarly, there are a lot of kind of nasty fights at the commission between oil dealers MEMA and the gas utilities, where there's a question of like kind of weighing in on whether gas utilities should be allowed to use funds in certain ways to promote conversion to gas away from oil. And MEMA comes in and argues, hey, this is anti-competitive. You're allowing them to use utility funds or use efficiency trust funds. There's an ongoing fight. And there's not guidance in state law that says, actually, we want you to come down on the side of gas distribution. We want to expand gas infrastructure. We want people to get onto this utility service. I don't know what the right answer is, but there's a lot of places that we see where some additional guidance about how the commission, which as Chairman Benoit says, doesn't do policy, is, or for the most part doesn't do policy, they're looking to guidance from the legislature, and here there really isn't any. What is our policy regarding gas? There's not legislation to do this. But I wanted to frame it as like an open question that we see coming up, where additional guidance in the legislature would be helpful. That's all the comments I have for today.
We appreciate the challenge in that last section. Any questions for the public advocate representing Senator Cushing?
Thank you. I appreciate, you know, your observations in regards to policy. It seems to me that we've had such volatility in the fuels market, i.e. the ability to explore for both gas and fossil fuels in the U.S. in ways that maybe 10 years ago didn't seem viable, that it's hard to have a reliable track record to identify whether you should strongly encourage one policy or not. I guess my question would be, as a public advocate in interacting with your regional associates here in New England, do you have any conversations that talk about what the regional impact is of attempting to gather more pipeline capacity and resources for Maine, or are you somewhat at the mercy of the policymakers?
I can separate out those questions into that question into two parts. On the distribution side, there's just not a lot of gas distribution expansion happening elsewhere in New England. Those systems have been built out, and I'm not, maybe other people behind me have seen it, but I haven't. Maine is, the kind of expansion Maine has seen in the last 5 years is regionally unique, where new people have come in and said, we're going to expand gas service. And it was really driven by some of that volatility. So low natural gas prices made people think it was a good idea to make those investments and do more expansion. We're seeing more expansion, I think, than other places in New England. So on the distribution side, not a lot of guidance to be had elsewhere. Regionally, we know, or it's a position of our office, that we need to do something about the pipeline capacity constraints during the winter months. It's driving higher electricity prices than we would otherwise have, and it's a problem to be solved. One of the ways to solve it is to do like we did in Maine, where we have effectively electric companies contract for gas pipeline capacity, buy it, and use it to lower electricity prices. But another approach, and one I think some people would argue we've kind of been coasting on for a while, is to have gas distribution companies buy, make sure that they buy firm capacity, and they're most of the time not using it, but they're sometimes using it, or maybe buy what they think they're going to need 5 years from now. Put your thumb on the scale to buy a little bit more. And that's the way that gas pipelines have historically been built in New England, is by like locking down that LDC load, local distribution company load. And I think my counterparts regionally who share our belief that there's a need for additional pipeline capacity have been remarkably willing to consider buying a little bit more gas from the gas LDCs to help solve that problem, absent any other way to fix this problem. I think it's kind of fundamentally inequitable because you're trying to reduce prices for electric customers by potentially increasing costs for gas customers, but that pipeline capacity is super valuable. So actually, Unitil's rates have been lower than they otherwise would have been because they're reselling some of that capacity during those very expensive times. So I think that's an open question. We've seen gas distribution companies in Maine start to purchase capacity, relatively small amounts in the grand scheme of things, but Maine Natural Gas and Unitil have both bought a slice of capacity on the Atlantic Bridge project, for example, to help move that project forward. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Woodson?
Based on the capacity of the current pipelines in Maine, how much more could it increase without having a need to increase the capacity? I mean, how close are we to being used to capacity?
I think we have plenty of pipeline capacity in Maine, although maybe folks behind me would disagree with this. The pipeline capacity problem we have is primarily a regional problem. So we're not able to bring gas into southern New England to where many of those natural gas-fired generators are. But generally, particularly once Atlantic Bridge is completed, we will have the capacity we need in Maine.
Seeing no other questions, thank you very much,
thank you,
Mr. Schneider.